APAMADA's programmes and facilities are supported through your generosity. Your support really does make a huge difference. You'll find a link for contributions on the website at apamada.org/contribute. Thank you so much.
You always have to remember when you're giving a talk that you're among friends. Not always the case in academic talks, so we have to remind ourselves. So today, this particular talk is for Heather. And of course, everyone else can listen in too. I heard your question about whether our practice has to be heavy and serious. And I wanted to offer a bit more of a response. I'm sure you've noticed a fair amount of laughter already in our sessions, right? So you may have a glimpse of something. And to begin, I'm going to share something that's going to seem maybe a little bit off the mark, but you can see for yourself. One of the wonderful things about coming home is that I get to be here like a tourist. I don't have any other responsibilities while I'm here. So Tuesday, a group of us went to visit the Blanton Museum on the UT campus. So we went to see this Blanton exhibit. And what it says there, which is too small for you guys to read, I'll tell you. It says, enjoy more than the floating world, masterpieces of Edo Japan from the Worcester Art Museum. So enjoy more than 130 wood block prints and painted scrolls from one of history's most vibrant artistic eras. After centuries of conflict and war, Japan's Edo period, 1603 to 1868, was a time of peace, stability, and economic growth. Members of the ruling class patronized artists, merchants, entertainers, and courtesans in major cities like Tokyo, then called Edo, Kyoto, and Osaka, sharing a visual culture and appreciation for the transient pleasures of life. Such diverse groups commingled in the metropolitan melting pot known as ukiyo, or floating world. There, a new art genre emerged, ukiyo-e. These pictures of the floating world depict the lifestyle, pleasures, and interests of the urban population, from samurais, geishas, and kabuki actors to boat parties, palaces, and lush landscapes. Not to be missed, this presentation marks the first time the Worcester Art Museum is touring its famed collection of Japanese artworks. So these woodblock prints, mostly or woodblock prints, were created because there was an increasing appetite for art and painters couldn't keep up, right? So they needed to have a way to reproduce art, and woodblock prints were the way that you could do that. It's a wonderful exhibit. I highly recommend it. Not only are the woodblock prints and scrolls that they have on display, but they also have a display that shows you exactly how those prints get made. Every single color on the print is a separate carved block of wood. And so that made it possible for them to create a scene like this and make it a nighttime scene or a sunset scene, or by varying the colors on the print. But immense amount of detail is possible through the skill of these artists. So as we wandered through the gallery, reading the informational plaques and gazing at the prints, there were some images that towered above the rest, like swans serenely floating on the ducks. Of course, all of the images were fascinating in their own right, just the technical skill and the color. But there were some that were well transcendent. They were the works of Katsushika Hokusai. So I wanted to share with you a little more about this artist, and maybe you'll understand why. Katsushika Hokusai lived from 1760 to 1849. At this time, there had been influence both ways among artists. So they were very influenced by Western artists who were starting to be more trade between Europe and Japan. So they were very influenced by perspective and the certain qualities of color that were in the Western images, and in turn, the West was very influenced by these Japanese sensibilities. So he's known simply as Hokusai. He was a Japanese ukiyo-e artist of the Edo period, active as a painter and a printmaker. He's best known for the woodblock print series, 36 Views of Mount Fuji, of which this is one example. Can you see Mount Fuji?
Yeah.
Hokusai was instrumental in developing ukiyo-e from a style of portraiture largely focused on courtesans and actors into a much broader style of art that focused on landscapes, plants, and animals. His works are thought to have had a significant influence on Vincent van Gogh and Claude Monet during the wave of Japanism that spread across Europe in the late 19th century. Hokusai created the monumental 36 Views of Mount Fuji as a response to a domestic travel boom in Japan and as part of a personal interest in Mount Fuji. It was this series specifically that the great wave off Kanagawa and fine wind, clear morning that secured his fame both in Japan and overseas. Hokusai was best known for his woodblock ukiyo-e prints, but he worked in a variety of mediums, including painting and book illustration. Starting as a young child, he continued working and improving his style until his death at age 88. In a long and successful career, Hokusai produced over 30,000 paintings, sketches, woodblock prints, and images for picture books in total. So innovative in his compositions and exceptional in his drawing technique, Hokusai is considered one of the greatest masters in the history of art. So I'm going to show you some of those images. These are not the ones that are on display because we have limited prints of those. This is that famous Great Wave, part of the 36 views of Mount Fuji. You can see Mount Fuji. So what captures our attention immediately is the wave, but there, serene in the background, Mount Fuji.
You see the boat and the people.
This iconic image is now available on mugs, t-shirts, onesies for infants, dog beds, laptop covers, and this is what we do with great art. This is another very famous image. There are many, many, many versions of this because he made many different kinds of prints with it. But this is the iconic image of Mount Fuji. Here are some travelers and a brilliant, brilliant sunset. So at this time, they had introduced a new pigment called Prussian blue, which was the first permanent blue, didn't fade. So the artists were all captivated with this blue, and you see it in many of these images. These are fishermen fishing by torchlight.
I've never seen that one.
Stars.
No views of Mount Fuji in this one.
Understanding. Okay, now I see it.
Can you see it?
No, I can.
Yeah, you see the movement,
yes.
The water, the fishermen, the torches.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quality of the light.
Yeah, quality of the light. This is what they're catching. They were working from photographs, on memory, or in the cases of humans, models. Travelers crossing a bridge.
It's very famous.
Yeah. So the water below.
People are so dynamic.
Yeah.
They're holding on to something.
And the leaves and the water.
You have a good eye for detail.
I went to the exhibit.
Yes. Yeah. And you can see that it's autumn from the leaves and the trees around them. Chrysanthemums.
Oh my gosh.
Whoa.
Every single thing on this print was carved in a block of wood. Every color was a different block. This is Hokusai's self-portrait as an aged man. And he said, "From the age of 6, I was in the habit of drawing all kinds of things. Although I had produced numerous designs by my 50th year, none of my works done before my 70th is really worth counting. At the age of 73, I have come to understand the true form of animals, insects, and fish, and the nature of plants and trees. Consequently, by the age of 86, I will have made more and more progress, and at 90, I will have got closer to the essence of art. At the age of 100, I will have reached a magnificent level, and at 110, each dot and each line will be alive. I would like to ask those who outlive me to observe that I have not spoken without reason." He wrote this autobiography in 1835. He's 75 years old, my age. I have not made 30,000 of anything except possibly emails. This is a poem by Roger Keyes. Hokusai says, "Look carefully." He says, "Pay attention. Notice." He says, "Keep looking. Stay curious." He says, "There is no end to seeing." He says, "Everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees. Wood is alive. Water is alive. Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside us." He says, "Live with the world inside you. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. Look, feel. Let life take you by the hand. Let life live through you. Everything is alive."
The wind blowing.
The paper is flying in the air.
Really, that man's
the hat.
Yeah, the hat.
Blown off. Clouds. It's good, isn't it?
Beautiful teaching.
So I want to talk a little bit about virtuosity as play. So we can stop sharing. Well, it's really fun to see this, but and I could look at it all day myself.
There we go.
So there is a tendency in Zen to be very serious, very intent. We're sometimes advised to sit as though our head is on fire. It's described as a matter of life and death of utmost importance. And the forms give a certain dignity to our practice, to our morning service, our ceremonies. We feel the import of the teachings, the precepts, the paramitas, the Four Noble Truths. We bring our wholehearted aspiration for awakening and for our vow to this very moment. We struggle with our hindrances, a pitched battle with our sleepiness, our anxiety and worry, our irritation and ill will, our longing for anything, our doubts about ourselves and about this path. We have nagging questions that agitate us, and our teachers refuse to give us any answers. Tell us what we should do, give us their approval, or notice just how good we are trying to be. This is what Heather observed. So the Fukan Zazengi lays out the fundamentals for us, and we catalog the many ways we fall short in realizing them. Non-thinking. We may feel we are just not trying hard enough, or just lack something. And Suzuki Roshi said, "You are all perfect, and you could use a little improvement." So for many of us, Zen begins as a self-improvement project, or more accurately, a self-perfection project. All of this true. All of this is valid to some extent. But is it really true that all we need to do is sit upright, hands neatly shaped in a perfect oval, tongue resting behind our teeth and lips? Is that it? So I've always been a very serious student of the way. When I was at Great Vow, the teacher gave me a koan, the very first koan you're usually given, mu. I struggled with that koan, gritting my teeth to give it my all, thinking of nothing else night and day, still in a fog, despite 10 days alone in a hermitage, doing nothing else. And this is after many years of practice, even after I'd been ordained as a priest. So finally, in desperation, I went to see Chosen, the teacher. I told her about my efforts, expecting her to sternly admonish me to try harder, to get a grip and break through. She looked at me, thoughtful and bemused. I always felt koans were like bonbons in a box of candy, she said. So delicious.
What?
This completely stunned me. It felt so playful, so lighthearted. I'd been working so hard. So I'd like to suggest that really Zazen is play, and we come together to play in this special way. Psychologists and sociologists have observed what they call serious play, play that is not a game, does not have a beginning, an ending, or a score, but is played alone or with others with great absorbing attention. Zen is like this. We have other forms of serious play, craft work, the arts, recreational sports, bird watching, singing in a chorus. But these other activities are not driven by vow, fueled by existential inquiry, or essential to the rest of our lives. So our practice is actually play, playful, as we can see in the koans, in the humor of Zen ancestors and teachers. There's a lightness to it, space and freedom. How else can we explain it? We don't do it to make money, to advance a career, to do the laundry, to lose weight, to improve our parenting, or our golf swing for that matter. It doesn't sort out our psychological issues or remove past trauma or end our various addictions. In some ways, it brings them more vividly to our attention. Unlike most of the rest of our lives, we aren't buying anything, consuming anything, fixing anything, solving a problem, making things happen, or being entertained somehow. Therefore, we must do it as some form of play, right? Somehow, we realize our Zen practice as extreme play. Our lives are on the line. Not like a mountain climber rappelling up a cliff in rarefied air, but like this ordinary form of play we call my life. So play is not chaos. There are forms. Even three kids playing with a ball make rules. Though, in studies of children playing in playgrounds, what they discovered is that the boys will stand together and discuss the rules. They set the rules before the game. The girls come together to talk about the relationships. Well, do you want to be the goal? You can be the goal. I think she's going to feel left out if she doesn't get to be the goal. Is it okay with you if she's the goal? It's like that. And that goes on for hours, you know. So, but in any event, forms, we have these forms, and they are a form of maybe like the rules of a game, in a sense. They're a shared agreement about certain constraints on our conduct, on our interactions, on our concepts and understanding about what works, what is fair, what is within bounds, or what puts play in motion. We enter the Zendo with our left foot and bow. It's not that the left foot is the better foot. It's not like the referee will blow a whistle if you step in with your right foot and give you some kind of penalty. That step and bow just sets this play in motion. Everything unfolds from there. It is the mindful expression of the forms that give play its dimensionality, how we realize the existential reality of it. Of course you can meditate anywhere. Don't be silly. But there's a certain communal gathering of attention and intention when we engage and practice together in this way. You might say it is a scaffolding for the deep play, the liberating play, in which we refresh ourselves and nourish ourselves. In true play, our attention is drawn in, focused, unhindered by distractions or disruptions. We are in a flow state that is essentially timeless. I remember playing with my best friend with model horses when I was really little. I said to Flint, I don't even remember what we were playing exactly. We had model horses. What were we doing? You know, like, I have no idea. But for hours and hours and hours, you know, not even hearing our parents call us for dinner, we were completely absorbed, completely transfixed. Maybe you've had the experience of learning something new. Watercolor painting, sailing a boat, playing a musical instrument, where at first you're awkward and frustrated and exhausted even after a few minutes. If you have the patience to persist, the unfamiliar demands on your body and mind begin to feel less distressing. You gain some little competence and actually begin to enjoy it. Ultimately, you forget the tangle of the beginnings and settle into the flow of the experience itself. Now you are dancing with it. This is how it is, not only on our solitary meditation cushion, but in our ever-evolving, dramatic, and dynamic play together, the essence of Sangha, the transmission of Dharma, the realization of Buddha. We're playing our lives like an accomplished musician improvises with her instrument, everyday Zen, everyday play. This play is a joyful virtuosity with whatever is ready to hand, whatever we can craft from it, like Hokusai, carving a woodblock into a mountain, a chrysanthemum, a windy day. It's filled with joy and vitality. And miracle of miracles, we get to do it together. So that's all I have to say about that. We have time for maybe one or two questions if they're quick.
That's why we sometimes say there's this aspect of Buddhism that everyone speaks about, the relief of suffering, but in many ways it's more the restoration of joy. Something that's essential.
So Heather, did that answer your question? Yeah.
It's interesting, you never hear a koan where, or a story where the method of enlightenment for the student was a laugh. You just don't hear that. It's a shout.
The student laughs.
Perhaps.
Yeah. It's often the case. Yeah. It's often the case, and it's often reported that way. You just start laughing out loud.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. It's partly like, you know, me hearing that koans are like bonbons in a box of candy. I just started laughing, you know. It was so completely beyond my concept.
Have you ever been to one of the yoga classes where they do laughter yoga?
No, but I know that's a thing.
The first time I did it, I was overcome with hardly able to stop laughing. It was so amusing just to see all of us, because we were told to lift our legs and we were rolling on our mats back and forth.
And laughing.
India was teaching it at the Town Lake Y.
There's this quality of play that I think that you're pointing to that's really important, that it's not the same as just having fun. Mm. There's lots of ways you can have fun, and it's fantastic, and I want to have fun as much as I possibly can. But sometimes play, it's not like there's a gaining idea. When you're playing, it's not like work where you're trying to get something, but you're completely involved in it. And sometimes you might feel happy or joyful, and sometimes you might not. Sometimes the play might be serious, but it's this, being captivated by something and being in it, you know? And
it's like Joel playing classical guitar. So your goal is not to get to the end of the song. That's not the goal, right?
Right.
Yeah, you're just immersed in this experience, and Joel came and played classical guitar for me. It was so moving, and I just felt like we were in this experience together, you know, and sharing it in that way. So much what I feel when I come into the Zendo, and you all are here.
We're not trying to get to the end of service. We're immersed in the playing and the beauty and the rhythm and the voices and movements. Kim?
Yeah, I heard years ago Matisse said something like, I've spent my whole life playing with color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can see that must have been the case for Hokusai too, because there's so much playfulness in his images.
I also enjoy when we read the Fukan Za Zengi. At first, I was a little annoyed that it's so long, but then I got into the play of the words and the sound of the words and how each phrasing, and it's just, there's so much there beyond just words, And that's a fun text to just enjoy the play of.
And sitting next to Clayton when she's saying these things, like I get to hear her individual voice, and there'll be the, and yet, there's so much personality in how she is in those words. It's really nice.
And that's an example of the reference I was making, where when we're all asked to do the same thing, mm-hmm. we come forward in our beautiful, unique way. You know, that's playful too.
So we're going to move, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so I have often thought the Coens are so dramatic, and it would be fun. It would be really fun to act them out.
Oh yeah, that's one way of study, absolutely. Is yeah. there schools where they, and we do that sometimes, we'll have a Coen, we'll, everybody take the different roles and
yeah.
just keep doing it that way and see what happens, to play with them.
Exactly.
See what happens when you're the one to cut the cat in half.
Or when you're the cat.
Exactly, we've all been in meetings like that, somebody say something. No. I'm twisting in the wind here. All right, well, we've probably come to the end of our time, right?
Some more to come in?
I'll just be very brief. I really appreciate you saying and embodying no shame with, you know, because when you're playing, it a lot of the holdback is thinking you're doing something wrong and so that's been, I think, a big, and that frees up and opens up an entry point to play, you know. Thank you.
You might think of it like a jazz.
There's no right, no wrong.
No, like it's like a jazz ensemble. So if somebody plays a wrong note, the other musicians move it, weave it into what they're doing. Yeah.
You know, like when I first started painting, I was like, bah. And one of the things that stuck with me was, and in watercolor, you can't really paint over, you know, the teacher says, you know, you do an unintended thing, which happens all the time. And she says, rather than, oh no, it's, oh boy, you look what I get. So, and we do it all the time.
Yeah.
In life.
A lot of us grew up with the idea that we had to do it right.
Yeah.
And that mistakes were heavily penalized, or wrong ideas were terminal to relationships or whatever, you know. We all had kind of have high stakes for performance.
And this can look like that at first glance.
Plays right into our conditioning.
Yeah. One of my first art teachers, I'd come to be her assistant as she was doing this big piece, and she made a massive mistake of something that could not be like
fixed.
She just turned, she like stood back and looked at it all. And then she said that she was embarrassed about me witnessing her do this thing that was gonna change it all. And she said, the difference between good art and bad art is what you do with your mistake. And so I've always taken like just that about art and—
That practice.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
Same teaching.
Wonderful thing to keep in mind.
I'm just kind of thinking about myself and about play and about dancing, or, you know, writing a poem or trying to play music or something like that. That the question comes up for me is like, who do I think I am to take this on? You know, to be able to have fun with something or to explore something freely like that. And it just came to me listening to this wonderful discussion that was the last question that Mara asked Buddha. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what was the question?
And he reached down and touched the ground.
Say it again.
It was the
It was the first question.
It was the first question?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was at the end.
Yeah.
The,
no.
And
who authorizes you? Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
do this.
So how did you meet the fellow who came today? They didn't know we're having a retreat.
I know him. I will say it was Kevin's husband.
Oh, right.
And I said, we're having a retreat. All the seats are assigned, so there won't be a place for you to sit. And he said, oh, I'll see you at breakfast.
Good. Yeah. But that's where someone attempted something, it was a mistake, if you want to call it that, and you didn't shame them, you just gave them information, and it was still welcome. It's an example.
I'm so happy to see him. I was very happy.
Yeah, happy to see him.
Yeah, me too. I had that exact same thing happen with Joko, where I came for evening zazen, and she came out and she said, oh, we're just starting a session. And she gave me a big hug, which had never happened before. So amazing.
She sent me off.
But I didn't feel dismissed. I felt connected.
She made sure you didn't.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
I got a good hug with Steve.
That's the only reason I'm here. All the way from New Jersey.
Come for the hug, stay for the zazen. That's how it works.
That's right. Oh, yeah. And some of the games that we play, we have uniforms.
That's right.
On this team, you know? The green team and the brown team.
Right. All right. I think we need to stop. Our timekeeper is giving me the eye here. Of course, we could play like this all morning, but we do have breakfast tacos waiting for us after service. So, just saying.